Good morning, and welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Albert Morales, your host and managing partner of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. We created the center in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us at the web at businessofgovernment.org. The Business of Government Radio Hour features a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. We are honored today that our special guest is Dr. Donald Lindberg, Director of the National Library of Medicine in Bethesda, Maryland. Good morning, Dr. Lindberg.
Good morning.
And joining us in our conversation, also from IBM, is Marion Ball. Good morning, Marion.
Good morning.
Dr. Lindberg, can you tell us about the history and mission of the National Library of Medicine and how that fits into the overall structure of the National Institutes of Health?
Well, actually, we trace our beginnings back to 1836 when a Surgeon General of the Army supported a library. In those days, it was referred to as medical books for officers. But that's basically how it started. So consequently, in a way, NLM is quite a bit older than the NIH itself. NIH actually had its centennial in 1987. We had a sesquicentennial in 1986. But the two were joined immediately after the end of World War II by a piece of legislation introduced by Jack Kennedy, which took the National Library of Medicine out of the military side, out of the Army side, and put it into what was then HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare. So we've been very happily united at NIH. It's a very good home and very good institution.
Can you give us a sense of the size, budget, and employee skill set at the National Library of Medicine, and how has that skill set changed over the past years?
Well, I guess a good response is to say that you never have enough money and space and people, but, but actually we're really quite happily well-placed in all of those respects. When I came in 84, the budget was $42 million a year. It's currently about $330 million. When I came, I think that the number of persons employed was around 600, something like that, and it's now around 1,100, so it's more or less doubled. I remember when I arrived in 84, some visitors were coming up and down an elevator, and a very charming guy who runs their Office of Public Information, I could just barely catch the end of this conversation, but somebody, one of the visitors said, "Bob, how many people work at NLM?" And I could just barely hear him saying, "Oh, about half of them." And then the door closed and they went away. But actually, they all work very hard and they're all very good.
That's a great story. Before and during your career in the federal government, you've made some important contributions to the world of science and the academy. Can you share some information on your background and career path with our listeners?
Yeah, where did I come from? Well, I'm a pathologist, so I'm a medical doctor trained in pathology at the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York. When I started, I was working on open-heart surgery, and I think I probably can take credit for discovering why a good many of the people were dying in the early procedures. In those days, the fatality rate was very, very high, and silicon embolization was one of those reasons. I then took an interest in infectious disease, and I actually brought some grants with me when I went to the University of Missouri. There, I ran in clinical laboratories, and my research began to involve the mathematical modeling of bacteria and antibiotic interaction, and then subsequently created, drifted into, I guess I'd have to say, computer systems that helped to run clinical laboratories, where, in fact, I encountered and partnered with IBM, and it was a very good partnership. Some of the early interface devices, the 1092 densely coated matrix keyboard, really came out of that partnership, and probably the first real clinical laboratory system, which they also, in fact, helped to market. So that was a very, very good beginning for me. Truthfully, anyone who does research in computers and medicine automatically knows about National Library of Medicine because they have been, so to speak, in the business almost from the very beginning of computing and medicine. And so I was on study sections and councils and stuff like that for NLM. Consequently, I never really thought about working for the government exactly. I knew there were lots of good people in government. I'd been, you know, had intellectual professional contacts with them. And I was somewhat surprised to discover in 1984 that the government could actually recruit kind of the same way universities do. In other words, you can suddenly find calls from people in and out of government around the country saying, "Now look, man, you've got to do this. You've got to consider this, you know, go to." And it was a time when two out of the three boys were of our sons were through college, as I recall it. In any case, we felt that we could make the experimental decision to find out, as I asked my wife, if she'd like to live on half salary in Washington. We found Washington quite charming, the government great, and the cities. It's been a wonderful thing. We're glad we came here.
That's fantastic.
Don, one of the questions we wanted to ask you is, how do you apply your past experiences, both at Columbia and then also at the University of Missouri, to the experiences in your current position?
Well, I can remember when I was thinking of doing the move to government that somebody said to me, now, you're going to really be appalled at how complicated the bureaucracy is in the federal government. And I thought to myself, man, are you kidding me? Can something be more complex than the bureaucracy of a state university? I mean, it's a pretty good training ground. Even, for instance, of the financial part, because a research group such as mine at Missouri, we would have had funding from at least half a dozen sources. I mean, some of it would be state, but most of it would be different kinds of federal grants with different starting and stopping dates. And at one point, I headed an interdisciplinary research center, which had people from seven different schools and 14 different departments, and everybody, I mean, every appointment paper was a work of art. I mean, there was no two the same. So from that point of view, the federal government was a snap. I mean, you know where the money comes from. Our guys print it. I mean, in other words, you know, you have an appropriation or you don't, but you're not going around trying to piece together grants from a million different places. So from that point of view, it was a snap.
Don, could we lead into telling our audience a little bit about your official responsibilities as the director of the National Library of Medicine?
What are the official responsibilities? Well, I guess it's to preserve the institution and make sure that it keeps getting better, you know, in general, and how to do that. When I first came there, I thought about this more than once, but when I first came, I greatly admired NLM. I mean, from the contacts I had, I knew it was a wonderful place. In fact, I knew a lot more about it than NIH, which is also wonderful, and I learned to admire that too. But I thought about it as sort of a grand invention, something like the Queen Elizabeth. And I thought of myself as looking out over the bow of this great vessel and once or twice a day saying, you know, half a point to starboard or something like that, Mr. Smith. Whereas, in fact, it turned out it was more like driving a Volkswagen down Interstate 270. Many times a day you had the opportunity to totally destroy the institution. I guess radio interviews are one of those opportunities. But there are others. So actually, I became increasingly aware. I mean, I didn't lose any respect for the institution, but I became increasingly aware that these federal agencies are quite fragile. I mean, even ones that have a long history behind them and are sort of big and have a sturdy building, they're very fragile. They can be destroyed pretty quickly. And so one has to be careful, therefore, to preserve the institution and to help it get better. And I hope that I've done that.
Well, I'm glad to hear you use the analogy of the Queen Elizabeth and not the Titanic. That's a different story.
That's a different story.
Can you describe to us the 1,100 or so employees at the NLM? What types of skill sets do these people have?
Oh, probably a quarter are doctoral level people and quite a few MD, PhDs. I mean, it depends, of course, on the division. The biggest division is library operations, and in that case, the professional degree is a master's degree in library science or something equivalent. There are a few people who do research. They tend to have doctoral degrees. Whereas in the National Center for Biotechnology Information and Lister Hill, those are the two research divisions, you have a much, much heavier load of doctoral people because, of course, PhDs are the research people. Actually, when I came to the institution, I found there was a bit of a separation between the library operation, doing the real work of the library, which I can describe for you if you wish, and then the thing called research, Lister Hill Center. And I found that there was an artificial separation, that research was spelled in sort of 3-foot-high Roman script, Roman numerals, you know. So I conscientiously have created interdisciplinary research teams heavily involving the library operations people with the researchers, and that's been very, very helpful to me.
We talk a lot with our guests about managing a highly skilled workforce, and given what you've just described, what do you see as some of the challenges in managing such a well-educated and highly skilled workforce, and how do you handle these challenges?
Well, I mean, the better the people, the easier the task, it seems to me. If somebody is afraid of hiring people that might be a bit smarter than he or she, they don't belong in this kind of job. I mean, the better the people you have, the better off you are. And so then the task really is only to enable them to do their best job and have the best ideas and explore and make a few errors. I mean, that's part of the deal. If you create a situation where every time someone fails, they're held up to ridicule and contumely, obviously you're going to go nowhere. So you have to create an environment in which it's possible to fail. If you have a sufficiently important objective and you try your best and you fail, it's okay. So I hope I have created that environment, and I hope I have created an environment in which people from the different divisions, let us say, and with different backgrounds, just naturally unite into research teams, because almost all of the major research achievements we've pulled off there since I came have been absolutely dependent on an interdisciplinary research team approach. And so I would say that's been my particular approach. I suppose there are others. If you're in a money-making corporation, of course, a measure can be the end of year, you know, income. We are not in that business. And of course, you know that in the true business of business, there's a pretty major debate whether people ought to be looking at quarterly dividends or they ought to be looking at five-year earnings curves. Sure. So we're definitely on the side of the – or try to be anyway – on the side of the five-year curves.
Great. What is Medline and how is it being used? We will ask National Library of Medicine Director Dr. Donald Lindberg to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.